Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. A new frontline investigates the spread of the novel coronavirus across the globe and how public health systems buckled under the pandemic. How many Americans died needlessly because of lack of preparedness here at home? How did efforts to encourage calm or even suppress information impact the response worldwide? What did President Donald Trump know about the virus? What did he understand about the virus and when? Tune in to Frontlines, The Virus, What Went Wrong? With correspondent Martin Smith and producer Marcela Gaviria. You can see it tonight on SDPB TV at 8:30 Central Time, 7:30 Mountain. The film also streams on pbs.org/frontline and the PBS video app at 6 p.m. Central. Martin Smith is with us today for a preview. Martin, welcome back. Thank you for being here. Martin Smith is with us. Hi, Martin. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. Good to be with you.
I want to start with some of the early efforts by the Chinese government to really suppress information about the new disease. And what was the motivation behind some of that, doctors who were speaking out and the Chinese government saying, no, you will not talk about that. You even see reports on the media threatening, police intervention if anybody spreads information about the virus online. Give us a little insight into some of those early days in Wuhan and the Chinese government response, please.
Yeah, the Chinese government wants to control whatever situation they're facing. And to have a young ophthalmologist, as was the case, on December 31st in a chat with his medical school classmates say that there is this strange pneumonia and we don't know what it is and we better watch out. This was too much. They surveil communications like this. They discovered this by using keywords. They came in, they arrested him, they brought him to the police station and made him sign a document saying he would no longer talk about his concerns. Now, this is a doctor, and he should have every right in a rational system to speak out and give warnings, especially he was only making a private conversation. But this was enough to get him hauled in and made to sign a document. And this is because the Chinese authorities want to control the situation. They were also the local authorities in Wuhan, China, where the outbreak started, were getting ready for New Year's celebrations, and they didn't want anything that would get in the way of that festive time of year. And so the idea that this was a dangerous virus that could spread from human to human was suppressed. It wasn't until January 12th that the WHO was able to put out a statement saying they thought there was human-to-human transmission. Unfortunately, the young doctor got sick in the meantime of COVID-19, died by February 7th, and there was a huge outpouring of support for him, a protest against the lack of freedom of speech and surveillance, and it's a sad chapter because months were lost, really, where the Chinese were sitting on the information and the WHO wasn't asking enough tough questions.
Right. January 12th, the WHO still is saying there's no clear evidence of human-to-human contact, even, which is completely inaccurate.
Correct. You're correcting me. It's January 12th that they say that, and then it's not until January 20th, 2 months after the first case in November, that they come forward and say there's human-to-human transmission.
Yeah, you mentioned the lunar celebration, the Lunar New Year, and there's a thread that goes through this frontline investigation that it's hard not to notice, the sense of, it's superstitious or it's bad luck to, to bring up news during the Lunar New Year. Later on, we talk about Vice President Pence and his relationship with science and religion. We see in South Korea a group of Christians who believe that their leader is the Messiah. And mass gatherings with them and even a soccer game, which you could argue is a religion of its own. But we see this intersection between superstition, religion, a lack of understanding of science. How much, as you put some of these puzzle pieces together, did you notice was the science really suppressed in favor of something else, whether it be faith or superstition or mania?
Consistently across the world, there is a distrust of science in so many places, not everywhere, but in so many places, a distrust of science, a distrust of government, healthcare systems that are susceptible to political pressures. And so, you know, another example is in Iran, where the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, came out and said that this is possibly a biological attack against Iran by the United States. And I asked the foreign minister, who, you know, is an apparently rational fellow, if he believed that. And he, of course, can't criticize the supreme leader. So he says, well, it's possible. It's not unreasonable, I think, is what his words were. So, you know, in Iran, the faithful didn't want to let go of their faith. They wanted to keep the mosques and the shrines open until it was too late. So you're absolutely right that, you know, faith, superstition, whatever, got in the way of science. And it's a problem, and it certainly was the case here.
Yeah. I want to go back to the president's daily briefings and kind of dig into this idea of what the president knew, what he was paying attention to, and when. When do, you know, notifications to the president or updates to the president start showing up in those daily briefings from his top officials? And does he read his daily briefing?
Yeah, I mean, these are mysteries, right? I mean, we have had a number of people ask him if he reads those daily briefs. He says he avoids giving clear answers to that. As far as we know, he may not read those briefs. But in those briefs, in January, in mid-January, even a little sooner, there were warnings that there was the possibility that this novel coronavirus out of China could come to the United States. And, you know, whether he read those or not, what he didn't seem to have a high-level meeting of any kind and discussion, as far as we could tell, until the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, gets to him later in January. And after trying for 18 days or so to get to the president, and then the president wants to talk about vaping and regulations of e-cigarettes, and there's not really a real grasp of all of this for really another month. Until you know, when you're talking about the president, you really don't get much action from him other than banning some flights from China in late January, not all, until sometime in March. And the nature of a pandemic is that it grows apparently slowly at first, but it's a phenomenon of exponential growth that I think is a science lesson that wasn't absorbed. And that is that you can have 10 cases and in a few days have 20 and a few more days have 40 and then 80. And it, by the time you get up into the thousands and you go from, you know, 5,000 to 10,000, it's really too late to do much about it. And that was essentially the problem, is a failure to grasp the seriousness of just what a few cases may mean.
And in those early days, you know, since then, much has been made about, you know, the public health response versus, or, you know, the impact on lives versus the impact on the economy and lives from loss of jobs and stay-at-home orders and such. But all that was, you know, those early briefings, that information on the impact on the economy was also provided to the president, and he responded slowly to that, too. How important was the strong U.S. economy to him at that time, the stock market and what he's watching, and did that provide kind of a blind spot that he didn't imagine, or that top administration officials didn't imagine, what kind of an economic hit the pandemic could also provide?
You know, I think you have to credit the president for having a keen sense of what a lockdown would mean for the economy, because he was really reluctant to issue stay-at-home orders. A study by Columbia University looked into this, and they found that had a stay-at-home order and social distancing orders been given 3 weeks sooner, the number of deaths in America would have been reduced by 83%. Now, that's stunning. A simple action like, you know, staying away from people, wearing a mask, washing your hands, staying at home when you can, would have reduced this whole thing by 83%, something we didn't do, and now we've got over 115,000 people that we've lost.
This frontline looks at the response in other countries as well, and of course, South Korea stands out. Why were they so prepared? Why did they have this army of public health workers? What was it that, they're having a meeting and figuring out the math, and 3 days after the meeting, there's, four companies have developed COVID-19 test kits, and they're, sanitizing their streets and their public transportation almost immediately. What did South Korea get right away?
Well, they had an experience in 2015 with something called MERS, or the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, that scared them. And at that point, they reformed their epidemic or pandemic response capability. And so when they had only four cases identified in the entire country, not deaths, but four cases of infection, they called an emergency meeting and they mobilized, as you said, the public health, both private sector and public sector of healthcare, and they put together a successful test, and they immediately got to work on testing. They thought they had it licked. They'd only found 30 cases. They were testing 10,000 people a day, and then they found an outbreak in southern South Korea in a city called Daegu, and they found a church where there was a lot of infection. The church leader, who's believed to be the Messiah, called it a witch hunt. But in fact, they had to test several thousand of those people, and there was a very high rate of infection. South Korea got on the case very quickly. You see these remarkable scenes in the documentary of these trucks coming down the street, spraying Purell on everything, and you have people washing down everything. I mean, they have the capability of calling on volunteers to come out, put on hazmat suits, which they have, and get to work, and they did that. It was not something that we were prepared and ready to do.
How much of that, Martin, it was, infrastructure, public health investment, and how much of it is, in your estimation, this caution about scaring people? I mean, even a doctor in New York City who is starting to see patients, this lawyer on the subway, and they think, oh, there's community spread, but they can't get a test, and they can't get a test authorized for this man other than his close contacts because it's not travel related. And even this doctor says, well, you don't want to be the boy who cried wolf, but this is starting to look like we have community spread in New York City. So talk a little bit, if you would, about the intersection between like just not being prepared from an investment and infrastructure standpoint to not being prepared in America mentally to this idea that, well, we don't want to scare anybody. We want anybody to overreact. What exactly is going on here? It seems like we just couldn't get our imagination around it. Is that possible?
Yeah, I think that's true, because we didn't have the kind of experience that South Korea and other countries had with MERS in 2015. We haven't had a huge outbreak for some time of any kind of virus. And so we... by contrast, after 9/11, we invested billions of dollars in counterterrorism and preparedness. Getting ready for a pandemic would cost a fraction of what we have spent on the military and other intelligence agencies to prevent a terrorist attack. But we haven't done it because we don't somehow, in our imaginations, consider health risks to be national security risks. But they are. And perhaps we learn from this and we go in another direction. I can't say what this administration is going to do or the next one, but clearly those countries that had an experience took this differently. The one Italian fellow that is interviewed in the program points out that we were seeing a lot of spread, but you can't really get people to take seriously the threat in those early days when they need to be. And when hospitals aren't overflowing, you can't get people's attention. But that's exactly what they did in Korea and in other places, Taiwan, Vietnam, you know, other, New Zealand has been very successful. We simply need to take seriously public health threats in a way that we haven't.
We talked about China and the goal of really suppressing that information and controlling that message. And there's a scientist, a doctor, who speaks out publicly, Nancy, I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name, Messonnier?
Messonnier,
thank you. I just botched her. Well, and oddly enough, I know how to pronounce Fauci, and I know how to pronounce. We didn't hear much from her after she originally spoke out, and then she
kind of
disappeared from the public viewpoint. What happened in that situation? Why don't we all know how to pronounce her name right now?
Because she was sidelined. Because she was like the doctor in Wuhan. Giving messages that were counter to the narrative that the political establishment, the administration, wanted to hear. And what had happened was that near the end of February, you have big outbreaks in Iran and in Italy and in Spain. And in America, the Fauci and a couple of other public health officials decide we're not being aggressive enough, you know, restricting flights from China is not going to stop this. Containment is not working. We need to do more. And so they schedule a meeting with the president where they're going to basically confront him and say, we need to be doing more. But this woman, who is a top official at the CDC, Nancy Messonnier, speaks out publicly before that meeting happens. And then the president goes off to India. He is trying to do a trade deal, which didn't work out. But in any case, when he's coming back, Nancy Messonnier gives another talk to reporters in which she said, this is going to be, you know, a pandemic. This is going to result in community spread. The president gets off the plane. He's very angry because he hadn't heard about this. He cancels his meeting with the healthcare advisors that he wants, that want to meet with him. And so the things that they wanted to talk to him about, stay-at-home orders, social distancing, all those warnings, that meeting didn't happen. And it was another 2.5 weeks before the president actually takes action. And those weeks are so crucial to the spread of the virus. If you act soon enough, you can stop it. But we didn't.
So much of what we understand now is also about the failed CDC test, the test that we developed that didn't work. A component was contaminated, and that cost time. And really, in early March, the president saying, you know, anybody can get a test, and the tests are perfect, which doctors say was completely inconsistent with reality. Do you have a sense, Martin, if the president knew that what he was saying was untrue? Were his advisors misinforming him? How did that massive disconnect happen, and what were the consequences of it?
You know, I wish I knew for sure. But, you know, in the case of that we were just talking about, Nancy Messonnier, when she gave that message and the president was upset about it, he devoted an entire press conference to walking back her message. When he goes before the CDC on March 6th and announced that anybody who wants a test can get a test, and everybody knows this is false, I wanted to know what was in his head. And I asked Dr. Redfield, who is the head of the director of the CDC, who was standing right next to him, and I asked him in the program, I said, you know, did you, like, take the president aside afterwards and say, you know, Mr. President, what you're saying is not true? He refused to talk about it. He said, I'm not going to talk about my conversations with the president. So we don't know, but I have to believe the president knew. Everybody knew there were not enough tests. And the president wanted to give, you know, he has said, actually, that he was trying to give people hope. He was trying to give people good news because they needed that. But, of course, we also need to hear the truth, and that is not what we heard. at that press conference at the CDC.
You can tune in to Frontlines, The Virus, What Went Wrong. It's tonight on SDPB-TV at 8:30 Central, 7:30 Mountain. The film also streams on pbs.org/frontline and the PBS video app. That's at 6 p.m. Central. Martin Smith and producer Marcela Gaviria have produced this really intense and informative documentary. Martin, thank you so much for being here with us today. We appreciate your time and look forward to talking with you next time.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.